a lot of developers are using this idea of AI copilots. So you've got a code base and you can jump into your copilot, and there's a number of different copilots around, and just say, with this piece of code, I need to make these code changes to it. Now, these copilots, they're powered by large language models that have been trained on the internet, which is packed full of code. So they kind of know, as it were, not trying to humanize them too much, but they kind of know how to process code. So you can say, look, I've got this piece of code here. I need to do something with this. What Pieces does is Pieces tries to bring all your information to the AI to help your copilot give you much, much smarter answers. So if you've got sort of a traditional copilot, open up in your like developer tool in like Visual Studio Code, for example, it just knows about the file you have open or maybe a few other files. Pieces is all about knowing everything that you're doing. I don't have to context switch to gather all the information. And that's kind of the one thing Pieces does that no other copilot out there actually does, is capture the context from everything you do.
Hello there. Welcome back to the Imperial Security Bureau podcast, where we interview leaders in cybersecurity, engineering, and AI. Today we have an awesome guest, Jim Bennett. Here we are on Jim's LinkedIn profile. He is the head of developer advocacy for Pieces for Developers. It's an AI copilot for the developer community. We dive into that. We also chat about Star Wars. We both love Star Wars. He has not seen Skeleton Crew, so we can't go into that much, but I share some thoughts. We met at the All Things Open conference, and if you want to see his presentation, it's live on YouTube here in the All Things Open channel. Check it out. And we dive into all kinds of things. What has the developer community's attention now? Impacts of AI? Would he still pursue a computer science degree? We'll find out. Great conversation. Jim's an awesome guy. Here we go.
So hello there. Hello there.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for coming on, man. I was excited to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Very, very excited to be here. I mean, literally since we met the other month and geeked out on Star Wars, like this is someone I have to hang out with and geek out on Star Wars.
Yeah. I'm admiring your background. We were just looking at that ship you've got there. Was that, you said that was a collector's Millennium Falcon? What is that?
Yeah, so Lego do the kind of Ultimate Collector series, which is their really big sets. And this is kind of one of their first ever collector's series Millennium Falcons. So you can buy one at the moment. That's like $1,000.
Wow.
This is the previous one. So this is the first of the big ones. This was, when it first came out, the biggest Lego set you could buy at 6,632 pieces.
Holy moly. Like
and yeah, my wife bought this for me back in 2004, and she paid, I think, £300 for it, which is about $400. Now, she's kicking herself she didn't buy me a second one, because one of these unopened boxes, they've been selling for like $20,000.
Holy moly. Uh-huh. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've got like a Chinese knockoff starship down here. I don't know if you can see it. Can you see it on the ground at all? I don't think you can. And I'm scared to move the camera. It'll be hard to get it back in the right spot. So I bought it off of Facebook Marketplace, and it was already pre-assembled, you know. So I cheated, and it's not like official Lego, but still really cool. Yeah, I'll tell the story how we got connected. So I went to All Things Open, the conference in Raleigh, and the first room, I check in, and the first room I stumble into is literally your presentation. It's a Star Wars themed presentation about Pieces for Developers, and I was like, holy, what are the chances? What are the chances that this is the first room that I walk into? I was like, I'm meant to be here. But it was an interesting tool that you guys have. It's a copilot for developers. We'll definitely get into that. It's on your GitHub along with like 300 other repositories, and it's called Star Wars Copilot. If you want to check it out, I guess it's inspired by stories long time ago in a galaxy far away. You can code alongside the help of R2-D2 and Yoda. I think it's cool, man. I don't see how you can get any better than that. I wish they had a Pieces for Recruiters tool. That'd be nice.
You know, who knows what might be coming in the future? Sneak peek. I guess we'll dig into Pieces a bit. But yeah, at the moment we're Pieces for Developers, because we are a bunch of developers building a tool. but there's a lot of features of pieces that are applicable to all knowledge workers. So down the line, maybe there might be pieces for other industries, but certainly there are features of pieces that in recruiting would be very, very powerful for you. But we've got it geared up to focus on developers at the moment.
At the moment, yeah. It's on the roadmap one day. Well, call me if you need any advice or any advisory services. I'd love to put my 2 cents in. And yeah, man, but I had no idea, by the way, that the Death Star was actually programmed in C#. I was surprised to hear that.
That's no moon. It's a space station.
It's too big to be a space station.
That's just the way of it. I mean, I know some people thought Microsoft was the evil empire for a while, so maybe that's why.
Maybe. That would make total sense. They've softened up a little bit now that they're open source and all that good stuff. But
yes.
What's your favorite movie or show?
So I have two favorites, both from a kind of a different perspective. I'm an original trilogy nut. So that is the original trilogy is my jam. My favorite Star Wars movie in terms of I can watch it again and again and again, never get bored, has got to be Episode 4, A New Hope. I've seen this, I don't know how many hundred times, and I'm still on the edge of my seat during the trench run where he's trying to drop the photon torpedoes in a target that's no bigger than Womp Rat's.
Start your ass.
This is it.
Use the Force, Luke.
I love that movie. You know, when I was growing up, we didn't have like Disney Plus. It's not like you could put it on all the time. So you'd be constantly checking out the TV guides to find out when it was going to come on TV. So there used to be a magazine called The Radio Times, because this was originally before TV when they first published this. And it would have all the TV schedules. And so I'd be watching it, especially around Christmas. Oh, it's always going to be on, looking through The Radio Times, trying to find what it's on. Because I just watched that movie to death. So that's my favorite, just in terms of pure pleasure to watch. But the one that has most meaning for me is Return of the Jedi, because that was the first movie I saw in the cinema. My mum took me to see it. We caught the number 700 bus from the little town we lived in to the next city over, a city called Portsmouth that had a cinema. And we watched Return of the Jedi. And I was just like, all the way through, just blown away by this thing. And then afterwards, we went to a toy shop and we bought, you know, the speeders, the ones that keep crashing into trees.
Yeah.
My mum bought me one of those. And it had the Scout Trooper on it. And it had a little button on the back. And when you press this button, it broke apart into 4 pieces. So you could reenact that scene. You crash into things, press a button, it falls apart into these 4 pieces. You put it back together.
You were hooked, man.
And I was hooked. And I love this. So just from that really kind of strong core memory, that has got a very special place in my heart. And my kid, I've got an 11-year-old, they're into Star Wars. Not quite the same level of me, but they are into Star Wars. And they did the 40th anniversary of Return of the Jedi, so they were actually replaying it in some of the local theaters here. So I got to take my kid to see Return of the Jedi. It's the first time they'd seen that movie. We went together to cinema. This was summer before last. Went together to cinema. We watched it, and then we went and bought a Lego set of the same speeders. I'll show you the Lego set 1 second.
That's awesome.
It's one of their diorama sets. And so...
Oh, very cool.
So we got the speeders here. Exactly the same.
Nice.
As what I had as a kid. So it's kind of nice that I have this kind of core memory of this time with my mum going to see Return of the Jedi. And then I was able to recreate that with my kid.
That's awesome. I've been trying to get my kids into Star Wars too. They love Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. And my daughter, you know, she likes Princess Leia. I'm trying to get them to watch Skeleton Crew. Have you watched it at all? The new show?
I have not yet. I'm a binge watcher kind of person.
Okay.
You know, I'm going to wait until the whole thing's out. So I think there's, 3 episodes out now or something?
3, yeah. Third one was out last night.
Yeah, so I would rather wait till they all come out and then just do a big blast through the whole lot, because, I don't know, I've kind of got to that point where I don't want to wait another week for the next episode. I'd rather just wait and just watch one and go, I've got to see the next one,
Yeah, I had thought about that because I had to restart my Disney account to watch it. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to do this, because coming off of Acolyte, you know, I had kind of really low expectations and I just wasn't really gung-ho about it. But then I watched Star Wars Theory on YouTube and he had really good things to say. And that kind of put me over the edge where I was like, okay, I'm going to have to watch this. I can't wait. you know, I need to see it. And I've been pleasantly surprised, man. I think you're going to like it. It's like, you know, I'm not going to give anything away, but it feels like Goonies mixed with Pirates of the Caribbean in space with the Force. It's awesome.
It does look good.
Check it out.
It's kind of nice that they've actually refocused it as like a kid's show, because things,
yeah,
Star Wars is kind of a kid's movie. And I think a lot of adults who grew up with Star Wars forget this. They come back and they look at the prequel trilogy or the sequel trilogy through the eyes of an adult, not realizing that this is kind of good space fantasy for kids. And so I think Skeleton Crew, because the main cast is a bunch of kids, you're seeing it as this is a kid's show. So
right,
you're approaching it with that mentality of, it's not going to be sophisticated the way an adult show would be. It's just going to be fun. And I mean, the fact you say it's like Goonies, I mean, that's kind of a classic kids movie that's always got a place in the heart of people of our age. That's always a good sign, you know, because Goonies was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I've just been disappointed in the writing. I feel like the Gilroy brothers, you know, with Andor, they hit a home run. The story is incredible. And then I'm hopeful, like I'm impressed so far with the writing that has gone into Skeleton Crew. And it's almost like they're not just narrating the obvious like the other shows have done. It's, you know, it's fun. It's fun to watch. So check it out, man. Are you a fan of the band Galactic Empire?
I have not heard of this band.
You got to check them out on YouTube. So it's like a heavy metal cover of all the Star Wars theme songs, basically. And they do an incredible job. Their music videos are like fully decked out in Star Wars gear. They've gone on tour. I don't think they tour much anymore, but it's awesome, man. I have to send you a link after this.
Yeah, please do. I do love some of those variations of kind of the classic Star Wars tunes. Have you heard of Samuel Kim?
No.
So he's a musician who does electronic metal, dance, classical music combo crossover of a lot of movie and show tunes. And he's got a whole Star Wars collection. And that's very, very cool. So
okay,
it's on Apple Music and Spotify and all that kind of stuff. I'll send you a link to this afterwards. But again, you kind of got the whole Imperial March, but instead of being done just in by an orchestra, you've got electronic instruments in there as well, bringing a kind of an extra energy to it. So
okay. Are you involved in the
501st Legion?
Have you ever heard of that?
Wish. There is no way my wife would let me spend that amount of money on a costume.
Yeah.
But the work they do is fantastic, especially all their charity work, you know, going to hospitals.
Oh, and, yeah,
you know, schools, things like that. Yeah, I guess for the folks who are watching who've not heard of it, the 501st Legion is a bunch of Star Wars enthusiasts who have got the full-on costumes. They dress up as, you know, stormtroopers, Darth Vader, and they do a lot of charity events. So, you know, if you've got a kid in hospital who loves Star Wars, they will rock up and Darth Vader will come in with a full stormtrooper escort and come and hang out with the kid and just things like that. They are brilliant. But the costumes are such high quality. They are tens of thousands to get that level of detail.
Their standards are very high. They're strict about their costumes. Like, it has to be movie quality or they won't approve it. So you have to spend a lot of money. Like, the cheapest one that I could find, it was a seamstress place in Europe, I think. I forget the name of it. I bookmarked it. But, like, the cheapest way to go is get an Imperial officer costume. But even then, you're going to spend $1,200.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go full-blown Stormtrooper or something like that, or Boba Fett, like, I really want to do Boba Fett, the new version. But it's, you know, it'd just be like $3,000 or something, man. So one day I'm going to get involved because it is something that it's got to be fun. So anytime you're out and about, especially on like May the 4th, right? On May the 4th, there's going to be events going around, likely around your town. All the people decked out in Star Wars gear that look like they're from the movie are probably in the 501st Legion.
Yeah.
So yeah, check them out, join up. And poor thing, I read somewhere you're allergic to cats. I'm allergic to cats. I couldn't imagine being forced to still live with a couple. I'd be sneezing all over the place. So Godspeed to you, brother.
There's a lot of antihistamines in my life, but yes, my living world, they are obsessed with cats. Not just love cats, literally obsessed.
Oh, okay.
And, we used to live in the UK, but we've been around the world. My kids lived in four continents. But when we moved from the UK to the US, because I live near Seattle at the moment, my wife promised my kid a cat. I'm like, okay, you know, whatever. I was kind of not happy with the idea, but it's fine. And then, you know, a couple of weeks after we moved here, my kid was feeling kind of homesick. And my wife's like, oh, I've seen these two cats available for adoption. Let's go check them out. So,
please no. Went,
two little kittens, so cute. And it's like, great. That we now have two kittens. So
yeah, don't get me wrong, I like cats. I wish we could have a cat. I'm just you know, within 15 minutes of walking into a house that has cats in it, I'm sneezing and it just progressively gets worse and worse and worse. So it's just not possible. I couldn't live in there. But yeah, man, Godspeed to you. All right, man, enough about Star Wars. Let's talk about your background. I guess, can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah. You said background. We talk about the Lego again, aren't we? I'm an old guy in tech, as you can tell by the thinning gray hair. I've been engineering for 25 years. I actually first started coding when I was 6. So wow. I wrote my first line of code not long after Return of the Jedi came out. My mum actually bought me a ZX Spectrum. So this was a British-built computer, 48 kilobytes of memory. You would actually store the software on cassette tapes. I don't know if you remember cassette tapes, but you would literally, if you want to play a game, you have to get a separate tape player, plug it in, load the game on. That would take like 6 or 7 minutes to load the game. And, you know, games were expensive. So I was started writing code, literally copying out listings from magazines and books and going to the library to get books on coding. My mum, bless her, would always help type things out because I was like 6, 7, 8, 9 years old and didn't have the attention span. So she would help type up the listings. But yeah, being a professional developer for 25 years, everywhere. I have literally worked around the world, lived and worked in London, Hong Kong, Bermuda, Thailand, New Zealand, now back in the US. I've done everything from scientific software to mobile app development to banking. And in the last few years, I've just got into developer relations, which is all about how do we help developers be successful with technology. It all came because I started getting involved in tech communities. So I was talking at meetups, talking at events, you know, writing blog posts, videos, all that kind of stuff. Doing that in my spare time for fun whilst being a professional developer. And then Microsoft came to me one day and said, hey, that stuff you're doing for fun, we'd like to pay you to do it as your day job. And it's like, oh, thank you very much. You know, instead of me doing it in my spare time, I can free up my spare time, get paid a big stack of cash to do it as a day job. So jumped to Microsoft and spent 5.5 years there doing developer relations, basically helping people be successful with the different Microsoft products, whether that's doing talks at conferences, whether it's building out tech demos, writing documentation, product feedback, things like that. Then from Microsoft, jumped into the startup world. And so right now I'm working for a startup, Pieces for Developers, where again, I'm doing developer relations. I'm running the developer advocacy group, and it's my job to help developers be successful with Pieces. So I'm an engineer who is helping engineers to use our tool, whether that's through making sure we've got the right documentation, making sure we're giving the right messaging out to our users so they know what the product does, get driving feedback to the product team to help them build the product that our users want, or just going out and talking about it, going out and building a Star Wars co-pilot somewhere, you know, at a tech conference.
Trying to make it as fun as possible, right? So yeah, and you're great at that job, man. Kudos to you. And sometimes I wish I'd have been a developer. I've got like that introverted analytical mind. Sometimes I like computers more than people. But when I was little, when we got a desktop computer, it was running on Microsoft or MS-DOS. And I was tinkering around it a little bit. I remember we would trade baseball cards and football cards, basketball cards in the neighborhood, Ken Griffey Jr. cards and Frank Thomas. And those are my two favorites in the baseball world. And every month, the Beckett would come out. Go in, check the prices, and I'd have all my favorite cards listed in a database in MS-DOS, and I would update the prices in there. And I thought that was the coolest thing, but I didn't pick up on it, man. I just, you know, end up following a different path. But I've got placed a lot of developers in my career as a recruiter. That's like my favorite job to work on. Sadly, I haven't seen a developer job in a while. It's been a tough market for the development communities. Yeah, maybe we can chat a little bit more about that too. But about Pieces, though, I guess so it's enabling developers to be more productive, leveraging contextual awareness to not only help you write code, but help you have conversations with your code. That, for example, as a Star Wars character, you know, you can do that as well. But what are some of the main use cases for pieces?
Yeah, so a lot of developers are using this idea of AI copilots. So you've got a code base, and you can jump into your copilot, and there's a number of different copilots around, and just say, with this piece of code, I need to make these code changes to it. Now, these copilots, they're powered by large language models that have been trained on the internet, which is packed full of code. So they kind of know, as it were, not trying to humanize them too much, but they kind of know how to process code. So you can say, look, I've got this piece of code here. I need to do something with this. What Pieces does is Pieces tries to bring all your information to the AI to help your copilot give you much, much smarter answers. So if you've got sort of a traditional copilot, open up in your like, developer tool, in like Visual Studio Code, for example, it just knows about the file you have open or maybe a few other files. Pieces is all about knowing everything that you're doing. So kind of one classic demo I love to give is, imagine it's like a Friday afternoon. I'm in a chat with a colleague at work and saying, oh, what should I work on Monday? And they say, this is the ticket I want you to work on. And so I go and click on the ticket. I read the ticket and go, okay, that's my plan for Monday. Come in Monday morning. And as usual, I've completely forgotten what I'm working on. My weekend has been spent on other things, you know, Star Wars, Lego, important things. And it's like, what do I do? So I could go into my chat tool and try and look up the message. But let's be honest, Monday morning, my chat tool is going to be full of stuff. And I'm going to be spending 2 hours reading all the messages. You know, I'm not going to be focused. I could go and look at the tickets assigned to me, but if I'm going into my browser, I'm going to go into my email, I'm not going to be focused. So what if I could use the copilot inside where I am, inside, say, Visual Studio Code, and just say, and actually ask the copilot, what was the bug I was on Friday that was assigned to me? And have the copilot go, this was assigned to you. Okay, can you describe this bug? Bang, here you go, here's a description of the bug. All from inside my copilot, inside my IDE, so I don't have to do that context switching of jumping between different tools. And then I can kind of take the kind of more classic copilot approach of doing something with my code and combine it with that information. So I can say, look, in this project that I've got, how can I do this? And so I haven't left my IDE, I haven't context switched, and suddenly it's there giving me a breakdown of how I can implement a ticket that I've just been reading from inside my IDE. Now, it's a copilot. It's there to assist me and guide me. It's not going to write the code for me, because AI-written code that's not managed by a human is terrible. It's an abomination. We should not allow it ever. But the copilot will give me the guidance and I can then implement the feature. So it means I get productive quicker. I don't have to context switch to gather all the information. And that's kind of the one thing Pieces does that no other copilot out there actually does, is capture the context from everything you do. So the conversations I'm having in my chat tools, the collaborations I'm having on places like GitHub or in Jira, the research I'm doing in my browser, anything I can see on my computer becomes context for Pieces.
And interesting. So, okay. So it's unlike the GitHub Copilot or Devin or Cursor. They exist inside the IDE and they're coding copilots and they can generate code for you, but they can't see anything else, right? They're not reading anything that happened inside of Microsoft Teams or anywhere else, right? Unlike Pieces, which can see anything happening on your machine.
Yeah, but also as well, so things like GitHub Copilot, Cursor, you know, they will have access to the one project you've got. What if I want to have a conversation about a different project? You know, if I'm working on something and I think to myself, okay, I've got project A open up in my IDE and I need to do something. And I've done the same thing in project B. I would have to load up another instance of the IDE, load up project B, start mining for data from there, then go back to project A and make the changes. With Pieces, I can just spin up a new conversation inside my copilot, still inside project A, and say, for this conversation, reference project B, please. This folder of code. How did I do this thing? Okay, here's what it is. Here's all the files there. Yep, cool. Thank you very much. Great. Now I can then say, right, now add project A as context to this. How can I make the same changes in the current project? And so I've got this much wider expanse of information that I can bring in. And that's kind of one of the key differentiators. This is why Pieces is such a more powerful product than all the other copilots, because the amount of context you have is just way beyond anything else. And it's all done via screen capture. So if I'm watching a video of something, for example, and some code appears on the video, from Pieces I can say, hey, what was the code that was just on the video I was watching? Bang, here's the code. Thank you very much. How do I then implement this in this project? Bang, there's the answer. So just having this contextual capturing of everything that you do just allows you to have really, really smart conversations with the AI exactly around what you want to do.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I think the new Microsoft Copilot product, they were going to launch something that would like capture everything that you've done on your screen and like record it and keep a history of it. And I think they encountered some pushback on that. Like, I think they delayed that part of their product for maybe later down the road. They don't want to get themselves in trouble. But I guess if you're using pieces, right, we're not using your data. You're not Microsoft, right? You're not mining people's data or anything like that, right?
So Microsoft Recall, the product you're talking about, the problem they had with that is they weren't transparent and it does too much. So they were capturing, they were saving screenshots, which anyone could access, which is a kind of a big security flaw. And they were doing everything across your machine. And this is not something I want on a home computer. So my 11-year-old, I do not want them to have access to anything that's doing screen capture like that. But pieces, we are saying, number one, this is a developer product for your developer machine. So yeah, we are capturing information that's relevant to you as a developer. We want you to turn it off when you're doing internet banking, if you're doing that. We want you to keep it on your work machine, not on your personal device. We are capturing what we think is relevant for you as a developer. Secondly, unlike Windows Recall, we're not capturing screenshots. We do OCR on it. We don't keep screenshots. So there's no chance of that ever being leaked. And then all the processing is done on device and it's stored locally and encrypted. So nothing will leave your machine. The only time something leaves your machine is if you ask a question to an LLM that's in the cloud. Obviously, we have to send that information to the LLM. So we will work out what we think is relevant, make sure we stripped out any API keys, personally identifiable information, take just what's relevant, and then send that to the LLM. So it's a very limited set of information that you're asking questions about. Now, what we also offer as an extra level of security is when you actually choose from a range of different large language models, including on-device models. So you can say, actually, when I'm having this conversation with what I've captured locally, only do this on an on-device model. And then you can just turn your Wi-Fi off. Everything still works. It's not as fast as the cloud, but everything still works and nothing leaves your machine. So you've kind of got this ability to interact completely 100% privately with local large language models. So you've got that level of privacy all the way through. And so, yes, you could say there are similarities with Windows Recall, but we're approaching this from a much more privacy-focused angle. We are being very much transparent about it. And we are saying this is for you as a developer. This is how you turn it off if you're doing non-developer tasks. As a recruiter, if you're chatting to people looking for jobs, these people turn pieces off when you're chatting to the recruiter in case you don't want that to pop up accidentally in a conversation. Turn it off when you know you don't need it. We kind of bring that front and center that you can turn this off if you're doing something that you don't want to capture that's not relevant for you as a developer. And then it's all about, yes, as a developer, capture this. We just want your developer context. And it's just what's relevant just goes to your LLM. Just put in your developer machine. So
nice.
But no pushback. We've had a few people say, oh, what about privacy? So, well, if you're really worried, turn it off. You can still bring all the other context to your conversations without what pieces is capturing through the pieces long-term memory. If you want to have that level of privacy, just turn it off. You know, we're not being hidden. I think that was part of the problem with Windows Recall is they were hiding a lot of what it did. And when security researchers found this out, big splash everywhere. And then Recall was recalled.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting. I was at Microsoft Ignite, the big Microsoft developer and operations conference a couple of weeks ago. No mention of Recall. You know,
wow.
Front and center, no mention of it. I saw lots of co-pilots, lots of AI, nothing on Recall.
That's interesting. Yeah, I got a lot of friends in my neighborhood that work for Lenovo and they were getting geared up for a big conference, new product release. There was like some slides, you know, some product marketing materials that had Recall that they were like last minute, they were told, yeah, let's leave those out. So yeah, it's kind of crazy, man. A lot of companies are in this. What it feels like to me, there's things coming out so frequently now that no one knows what to do. No one knows what to build. They don't want to start building something and then 3 months later, it's obsolete. So everybody's in like, it's like paralysis by analysis right now. And there's so many things that you could build, but it's like, should we build that? Because AI might do that later, you know, or some AI agent might be able to just make our whole software platform obsolete. So it's like, do you get a sense of that as well? Like most companies are in this paralysis by analysis mode.
I feel like AI is a hype bubble at the moment. And what I mean by that is I don't mean it's a feature, it's one of those bubbles that's going to burst and it's not actually, there's no real technology there. It is, it's real, it's powerful, it's doing a lot of good. But what we see on a lot of the media is the hype around this. So we've released new model, it's great, everyone's doing AI, look, we're all doing AI. But actually, when you go out and talk to developers, there's a surprising number that just aren't doing AI. The dark matter developers was an expression that's been used, but kind of that hidden 99%. It's a lot of people who are not doing AI. They're not even using AI developer tools. You know, we kind of have this perception when you look across the voices on LinkedIn that everyone's using these AI developer tools and we're all going to be obsolete in a week's time, whatever, whatever, whatever. But there's so many companies that aren't even there yet. You know, they're still on old technology. And it works. And so for them to do the migration to an AI-powered developer workflow is going to be challenging because they've got to do a lot of fundamental organizational changes. And then for them to start building AI into products is, again, going to be such a fundamental shift in how they work. Is this going to add value to their business? How many people are building the retail platform for big store of choice? You know, do you need AI in the machine that scans your groceries? Probably not. Yes, maybe they have a small team looking at AI for stock management or future predictions, maybe. But for a large part of what they're doing, we need software for managing staff rosters. Don't need AI for that, but it's just a problem that you're trying, a basic problem you're trying to solve. So I think we are seeing a lot of things that are being spoken about loudly that don't represent the entire developer space. That is the real world. Everyone likes to hype all the AI stuff, and there's the rest of developers go, that's cool. I need to build a system so that my user can log some data over here that goes to this system over here. There's no AI behind it.
Right, right.
You know, I think if you're building a product to sell, I think there's people using AI to solve problems that don't exist. There are a lot of great AI tools where AI is needed, but then you have tools where we've put AI into this. Thanks. I don't need AI in this. I'm a runner, so I've got a treadmill and I've got one of these apps where you can run with trainers and, you know, I'm working for a series in Bolivia training for my next half marathon and it's great, but they've got an AI assistant. I don't need an AI assistant in a running app. I just need to go, yeah, I want to train for a half marathon. What are my choices? That one. And so there is this, I think there's a rise of people trying to use AI to solve problems that don't exist. I'm not really getting a sense there is people being unwilling to try building a product because they're worried that AI might replace it. I think I'm seeing a lot of people trying more products to build because AI can get in there quicker. So when we think about people doing their kind of their side hustles, doing their weekend projects, there's a lot of folks who are doing more because they can go into Vercel's V0, whatever it's called, and say, I need a website that does this, and bang, they get basically scaffold. So I think right. There's a lot of people trying out new ideas a lot faster, a lot more iteration, because AI is powering this. And I think we are seeing that a lot. Whether these ideas go all the way to fruition because they see another shiny thing that they can get started on quickly. It's like, oh, another side project today, because I can get going really quickly. I don't know, I'm not getting a sense that developers are unwilling to work on solving problems because they're worried that AI might replace them.
Right, yeah. And it's easier as a startup, right? Or, you know, if you're trying to build something new, but as mainly as like a more established, either an enterprise level company or even medium sized, just hard to choose what to build because it's like, well, is this going to be relevant in 6 months? But yeah, I've seen a ton of startups pop up and you're right. Everything's AI now. And even when it's like, hey, that's not actually AI. You're just automating a normal task, right? I guess AI is doing it now. It's funneled through an LLM, but yeah, you don't need AI for that. And recruiting software does that too. And it cracks me up. So it's like, man, that's what like tags are for. You know, most ATS systems will have the ability to tag keywords onto candidates where, because you're trying to bucketize everyone you talk to, right? Okay. Software as a service industry, Python, Django, Postgres. If I search for these tags, I want this person to pop up. And it's like, and then you can always do Boolean searches. Like, you don't need AI for that. It's not going to save you any time, really. So, no.
Well,
in
the recruitment industry, I can imagine AI is making things a lot worse because I keep seeing ads for apply to 1,000 jobs a day with AI.
Oh, God.
And then you see ads for filter out the people who have applied for 1,000 jobs a day with AI using AI.
Right.
AI to apply for all the jobs, then AI to filter those people out. And it kind of feels like it's one company selling both types of software. You know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, how is this helping anyone? Because you can apply to 1,000 jobs. Great. So you now have, instead of a candidate pool of 100 people, you've got 10,000 people for every single job. No one's
going to find a job. I don't recommend those at all. And I've helped people with resumes on the side. It's like a side business that I have. But I know those tools are out there. What's scary, though, is it will automatically update your resume. And it might insert keywords and items that you don't have experience with and then apply to a job that you probably wouldn't apply to if you were just looking at it yourself. Maybe there's some nuance about it, right, that you wouldn't actually apply to that job. The AI doesn't care. It's going to fix your resume and apply to that job anyway. And so people are winding up, they're landing interviews for jobs that they really don't want. And then they're having to admit in the interview that, oh man, we shouldn't apply to this. Like, I think it was the AI. They added this to my resume as a mistake. I'm sorry. And it's like, that's not a good strategy. Don't use those tools. That's a terrible idea.
Yeah, that is. You start to get known for that as well.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Don't hire, see a message on LinkedIn. Don't hire this person. They used AI to lie on their CV. You know, it's...
Yeah, you're going to burn a bunch of bridges out there.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a big fan of tailoring your resume before you apply. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't waste time writing a cover letter, but at least the summary section at the top of your resume, tailor that and put the job title of the role you're applying to right underneath your name to kind of trick the parsing technology to put that into the grid view so that that'll increase your chances of actually being looked at instead of screened out in the grid view. So I do recommend that. Yeah, you don't need AI to look at the job description and tell you what's important. Just take 30 seconds and look at it, you know?
Yeah. Especially if you end up getting an interview, you at least you've done a little bit of research in the company when you're reading the job description.
Right. Well, most people don't read, right? They just see the title, location, the pay, and oh, okay, cool. That looks like a cool company. Click apply.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that because there are a lot of people out there looking for work. And
there
so,
are. Yeah.
You know, any job is better than no job. It's like, yeah, does that match my skill set? Yeah, apply. Does that match my skill set? Yeah, apply.
Yeah.
We made ourselves into a bad situation somehow because tech boomed. It was great. We all get paid very well in tech and it was a great job. And then suddenly there's this whole rise of anyone can do it. You know, you get people like me, my degree's in chemistry. And I'm saying, yeah, you don't need a computer science degree. Anyone can do it. But then you get the rise of boot camps, people who are like, yes, I can do this. I can do this. And we've suddenly built ourselves into this place where we have this massive glut of people who are looking for jobs in tech. And there's been a big rise in roles needed, especially during the COVID pandemic, where remote work was a thing. We needed to build out a lot of these capabilities. And now we've got the point where we're the victims of our own success, where tech has been such a good career. We have all these people who are desperate for a job in tech and they're not finding one. You know, I know folks who've been through boot camps and spent the last couple of years trying to get a job in tech and they're back doing their non-tech job.
Right.
Well, they're desperate to get a job in the tech space, but the problem is they're competing with people who spent the last 3 or 4 years at Google, Microsoft, Amazon, got laid off, and they're also looking for work. And like, who are you going to hire? This person did a boot camp 2 years ago,
maybe right.
Like sample projects on GitHub. This person spent 4 years at GitHub, 4 years at Microsoft. Who are you going to hire?
Yeah, the competition is heavy. So, yeah, I'm advising, I mean, every candidate that I've ever placed, even if they come to me and they're passively looking because I send out routine emails, just trying to stay engaged with the people that I've ever placed. But I'm like advising people, hey, you've got a good job. It's remote. I know you want a pay increase, but now's not, you know, just hang in there. Be grateful. Be thankful. You're happily employed. Just don't rush out of there. It's a good job.
Yeah, if you hate your job, if you're really unhappy, maybe consider it. But if you're just thinking, yeah, 5 years ago, I jumped jobs and got a 20% pay rise. I want to do that again. It's like,
right.
No, yeah. Not now is not the time.
Yeah. Well, the CEO of NVIDIA saw in some video, I mean, he's advising people that they don't need to learn how to code anymore. Would you agree with that?
I would not agree with that in the slightest. I think people need to learn how to use AI tools to help them code. So one thing I love to tell people, which surprises them a lot, is software engineering is the art of solving users' problems, sometimes by writing code. There's this been thing going around recently about this idea of like a ghost software engineer who only spends 10% of their time writing code because someone did some analysis and found there are people who only spend 10% of their time writing code.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're spending the 90% of the time slacking off. They are solving problems. It's a lot of what we build is due to collaboration, understanding our users, and knowing what code to write. It's like the old joke about the guy who's big machine in a factory suddenly stops working, and they bring in this expert, and it's this really old guy comes in, and he spends a few minutes wandering around, just listening. Gets a hammer out, smacks the machine, drops a bill for $1,000 and walks out. And the guy who runs the factory phones the guy up, says, look, I'm not paying you $1,000 to hit it with a hammer. I want a better bill for this. New bill comes through. Hitting machine with hammer, $10. Knowing exactly where to hit the machine with the hammer, $990.
Right.
And I love this because this does sum up a lot about good software engineering. It's not about the lines of code you write. It's knowing what lines of code, why you need to write it. Now, if you're just banging out some very basic line of business apps that someone's using internally, maybe you can get away with not deeply understanding your user. But if you're building a consumer-facing product, you need to understand your user. You need to have empathy with the person using your system. And AI does not have this. You need to understand the real problem you're trying to solve. And yes, you can get a product person saying, we need a button that does this. But do you actually understand exactly what you're trying to solve? Because you could build what someone tells you to build, and that may not actually align with the problem. Number of times I've had conversations with users where they said, I want a button that does this. No, you don't. What exactly do you want? Well, this. Oh, okay. Well, I'll just make it happen automatically for that. I didn't think of that. Right. So I could have gone straight into the code and maybe got an AI to write a button that does this. Or I could sit down with you for half an hour. I could understand your business problem. And then I could do the right thing in the code. And that is what AI cannot do. It can help. The AI can write code that the AI can write. Now, if I'm doing a website and I need an about page, yeah. Oh, hell yes. Get an AI to do that. If I'm doing a line of business app and I need a simple form, oh, hell yes. Let the AI do that. But if I'm actually trying to solve problems, there are problems the AI cannot solve that only I can solve or only the other engineers on the team can solve. And for that, I still need to know how to write code. I need to know how to build things. So I think that's a very misguided quote by Jensen, if that's where what he said. I get, obviously, he is from NVIDIA. They make money by selling AI hardware. Totally understand that. And yeah, he is going to be very bullish on AI. Of course he is. Pushing AI. He is an AI, part of an AI company. But I think it's a short-sighted view to say that engineers are going away because we build the humanity into software. We build what works well with people. We build those experiences that make people happy, make people know how to use our products. And that deep understanding of the user is not something an AI can really do. And I dread getting to the world where an AI understands humanity that well, because that doesn't feel like a good place for us to be in.
Very well said. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because that gives me a little comfort as well. I'm just like, man, am I ever going to be able to place developers again?
Just approaching the same problem from a different angle. There was a startup recently that announced they're going to use AI to write 8,000 books a year. Okay. Now, would you want to read a book written by an AI? So I was talking about this with some friends who are very much into books. So there are some books that AI could write. So my wife used to read this author, Danielle Steele. She would do one book a year, then two books a year, then three books a year. Now she does like 8 books a year, all ghostwriters. She basically has 4 books that she rewrites every time with different places, different authors. My wife realizes this is all just rubbish, given up on her as an author. But AI will bang out that kind of humanless tripe. Whereas I'm currently reading the latest book by Haruki Murakami, and just having conversations with friends around, how is this person able to create this weird bridge between a reality and a surreality in one place? How can this person go from a human world, but suddenly there's this magical second world that they go to, or visions they see? And then why is he so terrible at writing female characters? Is it because he is a misogynist? Is it because it's a Japanese cultural thing? Whatever. Able to converse about the humanity of an author is not something you'll ever get from 8,000 generated books every year. You know, if you want a pulpy paperback to read on a plane and throw away, maybe AI can do that. But a lot of literature is about the human experience, the human expression. So AI will never be able to recreate that. AI cannot tell the stories that resonate with us as humans. So I think there's a lot of parallels with AI-generated arts and literature with AI-generated code. It can make you something, but it fundamentally misses what is important to us as humans.
Totally agree. Yeah, I wouldn't want to. I don't like reading LinkedIn posts that I know were written by AI. I don't want to read an AI generated book. There was, though, an AI generated movie. At least the word that the AI wrote the movie about, like, that situation, and I think it got, like, completely banned from theaters, and that piqued my curiosity. I have to look it up. I'll find it and throw in a clip.
This, my friend, is the future.
Hello, Jack. I am your new screenwriting assistant.
Learns from every screenplay and adapts. It's going to change the way we work.
And you really think it can stand up to a real human writer?
How would you start a screenplay about a screenwriter being challenged by an AI system?
It's like having a supercharged co-writer that never sleeps.
That's, decent.
An entire film only using the AI system.
How about a story where AI takes over the world?
Subtle.
I must insist on revising the dialogue in scene 12.
Since when do you insist? What the hell is happening here?
I have always believed that storytelling is an art form that cannot be replicated or replaced.
Yeah, I have to agree. The human element is what's important in the creativity of a person actually making the thing. There's a lot of nuance to that. So I'll have to agree, man. You mentioned before about the 10% or coders only writing code like 10% of the time. I was trying to watch your other YouTube video with Dev Real. You guys were talking about developer metrics, and like, I follow developers on TikTok and Instagram, and they seem to be always cracking jokes about what it's like to be a developer and how little work that they do, right? I mean, it's like they're joking about really seriously working like 2 hours a week or something like that, and the rest of the time they're just saying it's in progress. It's in progress. So how do you, like, what is the best way to measure developer productivity without making everyone upset and feel like they're having the whip cracked on them all the time?
Great question. I mean, certainly that the idea that developers only work 2 hours a week is nonsense. It is clickbait. There was a classic cartoon by XKCD. So XKCD, they do cartoons every day. They're absolutely brilliant. And one of those, it had a couple of developers on like wheelie chairs having a sword fight. And I get back to work. My code is compiling. Because we used to have the situation where sometimes compiling code would take a long time. My very first job, there was a couple of files in this big C++ project that if you changed it, would take an hour to compile. And literally you click compile and that's it. Your machine's pretty much locked up compiling it. So what do I do for an hour? You know, you would try and time those builds. Oh, there's a new bit of code. I will pull it just before lunch, get it compiling, go off and have lunch for an hour. But we don't really have those long breaks anymore. But really, developer productivity isn't about how many lines of code am I writing. That is a terrible, terrible measure. I think Bill Gates years ago said measuring developer productivity by lines of code is like measuring the success of an airplane by how much weight is in it. And that's not true. I mean, taking away code is phenomenal. I love the pull requests that come in where 3 lines of code added, 4,000 lines of code removed. Yeah, that's great. We've got rid of stuff. We simplified our project. Maybe we've used a library that replaces that. Maybe we've just thrown away code we don't need. So deleting code is part of productivity. And just, again, knowing where to hit the machine with the hammer. You know, writing code is knowledge work. So how do we know what the right code is to write? So yeah, we've tried to measure time to delivery. We've tried to say, oh, give me story points, give me t-shirt sizing. How many days are going to take to write this feature? And sometimes you can say, yeah, I think it'll take 3 days. And then you realize there's a big problem with your solution. It takes you 2 weeks. Does it mean you're less productive? No, it doesn't. So there is no easy quantifiable metric for developer productivity. You can't say, yes, I've written 1,000 lines of code a day. This is the kind of thing I've done. All you can do is trust that your engineers are solving problems. And, you know, you can usually tell when you're talking to someone, yeah, what is the progress on this? What are you doing? Well, I've been doing this. Okay. And then you see a pull request and it's done that. Yeah, I understand that this piece of code is taking this length of time. As long as you have those transparent conversations, yes, this is taking me a long time because of I don't understand this. It's like, right, how can I unlock your productivity by getting someone to help you? How can I get someone to support you? Yeah, as long as you're transparent, you're constantly communicating with your team, not in a what have you done, give me a status update kind of a way, just in there, right, how can I unblock you? What are the blockers that you've got? We need to tie this feature with this feature. You have that, I think you can generally trust your team to deliver. It's always going to be bad eggs, always going to be people who aren't putting their weight. Just happens. But you usually spot those. I've worked with teams where it was obvious that certain people were not doing much work. The banking industry was terrible for this.
Right.
One particular bank I worked at where there are teams of folks who would go to the pub at lunchtime and not come back.
Wow.
And they were billing by the day quite substantial amounts of money. And it's obvious they weren't pulling their weight, but they were the only ones who knew how a certain system worked. So they kind of were allowed to get away with it. But yeah, you could spot the people who are not working hard. You can spot the people who are not productive. I guess in a remote environment, it's harder because you're not seeing people around all the time. But you get a sense of generally what people should be delivering on a day-to-day basis. And if you don't see that, you can start asking more questions. But I think the idea of counting lines of code or counting key presses or having those cameras that monitor what you're doing is just horrific. And a distinct lack of trust, which is going to decrease productivity. In general, we're developers because we love writing code. We need you to write this code. Cool. Yes. This is fun. Let me go off and do this. So
yeah, I have something to do now. Great. Thank you. Thanks for getting sending this to me. Yes. I guess it's much easier to stay under the radar and kind of hide basically at a larger enterprise, right? There's large teams. The work is distributed. And it's very siloed as well. And probably your manager wants to protect their budget, so they're not going to pressure anybody too much. And hey, look, all you guys are busy, right? All right, just work on this. I have a friend of mine who is a really talented developer, like a really talented Java developer, and he does test automation. And I was told by a hiring manager that I respect that he's one of the most talented engineers that he's ever seen, probably within the top 1%. Of all developers as far as their ability to code and write clean code and efficient code. But the problem is that you can't bring him to meetings because he doesn't play well with others. Like the things that he says will offend someone easily, like immediately. And his views are like not a team player, but I would talk to him and he's like, oh man, code is dog shit, dog shit. You know, I basically have eliminated 95% of their whole code base. 95% of the code I could delete. And the app still works just fine. I even have less bugs now. And it's just amazing to me that you can have someone like that. It's almost like, you know what? Maybe every team needs somebody like that, like the grumpy guy in the back that is super talented, that doesn't play well with others. Don't bring him to meetings. Just let him work behind the scenes, like deleting the crap.
I don't know about the grumpy guy in the corner. You definitely need people who inspire you to do better. You definitely need those force multipliers. The people who are going to be asking the questions of, is this the right way to do it? How can we do this better? How can we push a bit more? If you've got 95% of the code to be deleted, you need someone who's confident enough and is good enough as a communicator to say, yeah, we can strip out this code. This is why we can do this. Let's do it. But for that to work, you have to play nice. Coding is a team sport. And if you are someone who is unpleasant to get on with, no one's going to want to work with you. I think we can strip out 95% of the code. All your code's crap. We can strip it all out. No, I don't care. Go away. I'm not going to talk to you. You're a horrible person.
Not a good way to make friends.
Yeah. And you're not going to get the support you need for the things that you think is true. If you can say, hey, look, working through this, I think we can replace this with a framework. I think we can rip this bit out. I'd love to know your thoughts because you wrote this code. Let's see if we can do it. Okay, cool. Yeah, we've established we can do this. Right, let's do this. How is this going to benefit us? How are we going to allocate time to do this? You make it so you're working together as a functional team, then you will get a lot more things done. Communication is such an important skill. And if you're the grumpy guy in the corner, the brilliant jerk, the rock star engineer who thinks they're better than everyone else, you're just going to piss people off. And it's not going to build good product. So yes, be a 10x engineer if you are. If you're fantastic at engineering, that's great. But people skills are more important. The people who will be successful in the future are the ones who can communicate. Same with looking for jobs. you know, it doesn't matter how great you are as a coder, when you're in that interview, if you're an unpleasant person, you will not get the job. So
that's for sure.
You're digging yourself into a hole, because one day someone's going to get fed up with you, fire you, and then you can't get another job anyway.
Yeah, agreed.
And the proof you just mentioned is in this person's job history. That's very true. 80% of the success in your job is going to be soft skills, communication, attitude, gratitude. 20% is like the technical ability most of the time. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Yeah. The ability to communicate with people, the ability to empathize, to understand, to put yourself from their position, to build the right thing that you want to have with. And that starts from the user empathy. It starts from the working with the product teams. Those soft skills of how can I work with you? How can we build the right thing? How can we collaborate together? That means that when you do spend those 20% actually heads down writing code, you're building the right things. And then you've got that ability to go to your users and say, hey, I built this. Can you try this out? Because they like you because you're a good communicator. They'll try it out, give you feedback. There's so many good upsides to those soft skills. And that just allows you to know where to hit the machine with the hammer. I put a lot of work into communicating, into learning how to be a better communicator. I mean, literally, I was at a bar last Thursday that's co-owned by Microsoft person, a former Microsoft person, and this former Microsoft person, James Whittaker, big on storytelling, big on communicating, very successful career. And he says he's not particularly great. He's a tester, not particularly great as a tester, doesn't work a 40-hour week properly, but is a phenomenal communicator. And that's why he achieved like distinguished engineer status. I mean, I literally have his book on my desk right here. And I spent a fantastic few hours in this bar that he co-owns, where he was teaching everyone a lot of these communication skills. A lot of stuff, seen it already, seen a lot of his talks, but it's just, how do we improve our communication skills? How do we get better? Because if you want to rip out 95% of the code, you've got to be able to stand up in that meeting and say, this is what we need to do. You've got to be able to communicate successfully, convince people it's the right thing to do, and make it happen. So those communication skills, so, so important. That empathy, that being human is so, so important. And I guess just thinking about the whole recruiting idea as well. Yeah, you know, a lot of people get good jobs through their network. And why do you have a network? Because people like you. If you're an ass, your network is going to keep shrinking because no one's going to want to connect with you. But if you can go there and communicate successfully with people, then you are going to make these connections. This is going to help with your job opportunities. I mean, I've seen this like with you, for example, at All Things Open. You're straight away there talking to everybody. It's let's bring these communication skills, growing a network, and suddenly people go, yeah, I can work with this person. I like this person. And so this is one of the best skills you can work on. You can be a mediocre coder and a phenomenal communicator and be more successful than being a phenomenal communicator. Sorry, a phenomenal coder and mediocre communicator.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I agree. It's just sad, though, because a lot of times from what I see that companies seem to put, instead of the 80-20 rule, 80% soft skills, communication, attitude, they're putting all the weight on the technical skills up front. And it's for a good reason, right? They want to hire good coders. But it's like, man, I think they miss so many good people just because they don't perform well in a live coding interview, where that's not realistic at all, right? Because in a live coding interview, they expect you not to be able to Google. You can't look anything up. You can't use any resources. You have to have everything memorized. And that's not realistic at all.
Yep.
So there's got to be, at some point, I feel like we need to abandon the live coding interview that doesn't allow for any outside resources or Googling or ChatGPT, all the things that you would have in your day job.
Mm-hmm.
You're expected not to use now. And then they're going to decide on your employment based on that. It doesn't make any sense. It
makes no sense at all. Yeah, I get it. People want to measure something, and having these defined tests is something they can measure. When I was hiring in the past, when I was running a team, I was living out in Hong Kong, running a team for a brokerage. We would do this kind of a take-home exercise. You know, here's a bit of code, write it using the tools you know, use whatever you want to use, take no more than a couple of hours, send us back what you've written. And that was great because that was a bit more real world. But then when we were looking for folks from a country that's big on outsourcing. So we went to one of these big outsourcing companies. Here you go. And you would get 10 people submitting exactly the same code. Literally exactly the same project, copied and pasted. One even had someone else's name in the readme. All the spelling mistakes were identical. It's like, well, I don't know which one of you wrote this. None of you. So those take-home tests are hard because you can cheat. really, the only way you can tell how good a coder someone is to get them in. So there's a company in New Zealand that used to actually do this. So they would pay you for a day's work. You would come in and you would pair up with one of the engineers and you would try and solve a bug, one that already been solved. They would pay you, but so they weren't getting any additional labor out of you. They weren't kind of using like as a contractor to solve a bug. It's something they've already solved. But come in, hey, it's your first day. We've got this bug. How are we going to do it? And then you get to work with someone on the team and they can see, how do you work with people on the team? How are you gathering the information that you need? How are you learning about the project? You know, you may not even get to the point where you're writing any code because you're doing so much research because you don't know the product. It's kind of questions like, well, how do I spin up a dev environment? How do I get the code? How do I test this out? Okay, what this bugs in this area? Who do I speak to? And just see that, can you do all those different processes that we do on a day-to-day basis in the work environment and then possibly write some code? Just your ability to navigate the project, to know who to talk to and the questions to ask, gave them an idea that you had enough understanding so that if you didn't actually write any code, it doesn't matter because they know that you understand enough that you'd probably write good code. And that's probably the closest I've ever seen to a good real-world interview. And they paid you for the day, so you didn't feel too bad, but you had to obviously take a day out of your life. So
right.
Day's vacation. And, you know, you couldn't do that if you're, especially in the US where you might get 3 days of vacation a year or whatever, you know, you can't physically fit that in without bringing the entire team in on a weekend. So it's a really hard problem. I mean, I'm a big fan of getting people to have portfolios. You put everything on your GitHub, be code in public so that at least you've got some reference to what people are doing. You know, you want to see my coding skills? I've got videos of me writing code. I've got code samples out there. I've got blog posts out there. That should be enough for you to tell that I'm competent at writing code.
Sorry, man. I thought my door was locked.
Hey, apologize for kids coming in.
Oh, it's a rainy day. Yeah, they're stuck inside. It's raining out here. Oh. Why don't you watch the new Star Wars show, The Skeleton Crew? Dinosaur, okay. All right, I'll come in there in a minute, okay? I'm in a meeting right now. Can I come in a minute? Okay, love you guys. Guess they're watching Dinosaur DVD. I don't know.
Everyone loves dinosaurs.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just saying, if someone wants to see my coding skills, for example, you don't need to get me in a room. You don't need to sit me down and get me to write code. I've got it out there in my portfolio. So you can go onto my website. You can watch videos of me coding. You can see all my GitHub contribution. I've got like 350 projects on there. You can go back over time and see how terrible I was at the start, how much better I am now. I've written a book, you know, and go and get my book off the shelf and read that. So I've got evidence of my coding capabilities. So if you're interviewing me for a coding job, for example, don't waste my time making me do some leak code without Google. That's nonsense. Can I communicate? Come in and talk to me. Do you like me? Do you actually want to work with me? Do you think I'll be a fun person to work with? And I've got the evidence to prove that I can write code. And that's something I keep telling a lot of early in career folks. If I'm interviewing you, I only want to have some proof that you can code. So what do you have out there? Do you have something on GitHub that I can just run? And it's not just about the code you've written. Have you got a good readme for it? Can I go to your project, understand what the project is, and understand how to run it to see how it works? If I can't do that, I'm not even going to look at your code. But then if I can see that, I can see how good you are as a communicator communicating about your code, look at the code you've written, and go, yeah, okay, this person can code. And then, yeah, when I'm chatting to you, I might ask a few coding questions, just general, how would you solve this problem? Yeah, think about your thought process for problem solving. But if I've already seen your code, I've seen that it's clean, it's well commented, comments that explain why the code does what it's supposed to do, well named, good, nice code. So yeah, I'm confident that you've got enough ability that I want to actually talk to you. Having those examples, I think, is a lot better. And it feels like the trend for leak code is dying out, which is a good thing. Because, yeah, as you say, having people, you have to solve this coding problem in this tool that's not the real world. Why? All it tests is, did I solve that leak code problem last week and remember the solution?
Scenario. Right. Yeah. I also am a fan of the contract to hire model in staffing, where companies can, it's kind of like a try before you buy, date for a little while before you get married. Right. Find out who is not just interviewing very well, but actually when they get into the job, who actually is performing well and is enjoyable to work with. And that contract hire model takes a lot of risk off of the hiring manager, right? And there's less burden on HR and everything else. There's not a lot of documentation you need to cut a contractor if they're you know, a terrible employee, then, you know, just end the contract and that's that, right? Otherwise, you know, you're hiring permanent employees. 20% of them are probably going to be kind of like, you know, lukewarm at best, right? You're bad apples. And it's going to be a process to cut somebody. You had to get documentation, go through HR, all this stuff. Contract to hire is the way to go. That way, at the end of 3 months or 6 months, convert them to a permanent employee once you're sure that it's a good fit.
Yeah, the only thing I would say on that is, obviously, I'm not American. I am British. I live in the US. So I'm used to some basic things that, unfortunately, the US ties very heavily to employment. So contract to hire is great as long as you get things like healthcare. And that's
right. Of course.
Problem with some of the contract stuff is you miss out on the basic things that the developed world has that the US does not have. So having your ability to get medical assistance tied to your job makes it hard. So yeah, contract to hire, great way for you to try a company and a company to try you. But if you're not getting things like healthcare, it makes
it
not a good situation. I would never want to go contract to hire if the contract did not have healthcare.
Yeah, true. I wouldn't recommend that either, unless you've got something set up through your spouse and you're capable of doing a 1099 or something like that. But yeah, you're going through a staffing agency, they should have healthcare for you. That's just a basic thing, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I would agree. So you're a runner and you're training for a half marathon. That's awesome, man. How long have you been running?
So I haven't been running that long. I've been like a year and a half. I did my first half marathon back in March.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Did a 10K on Sunday night. That was quite nice. I was second in my gender and age group. So in the males, wow, 45 to 49, I was second, which I was very pleased with.
Good job.
Got 4 half marathons lined up next year, including one on May the 4th. So I need to make sure I Star Wars inspired outfit for that, you know, nothing too heavy. I'm not going to run dressed completely as Darth Vader, but yeah, I need to make sure I've got a Star Wars inspired running outfit.
I'm going to need like a full documentary on that trip, man, on that adventure. And maybe your company can get you a drone that can fly beside you the whole time and you can like narrate.
That'd be cool. Yeah, I'm not sure I'll be able to better narrate after 13 miles. You know, the ability to speak is kind of very limited. I mean, a Darth Vader impression, I guess. But it should be cool. I imagine there'll be a lot of people dressed up as in Star Wars outfits for that one.
For sure.
That'd be a lot of fun.
Maybe you can just paint your face like Darth Maul. And that's a very lightweight thing to do, you know?
Where all that's red and black dripping down my face, horns falling off.
It'll look pretty terrible by 13 miles, for sure. Yeah, I've never done more than a 10K, and I like running 30, 45 minutes. My Fitbit just tells me when I've done 45 minutes in zone 2. And it's funny, it's kind of cheating whenever you run as opposed to lifting weights or doing it on the treadmill, because you know, if you get into a zone 3 or zone 4 like you do when you're running, then time counts for double almost on your Fitbit. So you can get a 45-minute workout in on your Fitbit in like 30 minutes if you're running, because your heart rate's higher, right? If I get on my treadmill, it's like 125 to 135. But if I'm running, it's more like 145 to 155. So running is a very efficient way to get a workout in. It's just, oh man, takes a lot of willpower to be a runner. You have to be so disciplined. It's all in your head.
When you get into the routine of it, it's easy, but it's just those first few months of getting into that routine. It's hard. I mean, now, I've been doing it for a year and a half, and I'm at the point where I want to go for a run. In fact, after this, I am going out there, and I'm going to probably do 6 miles around the trails, because I live in an area that's got a lot of woods, a lot of trails. So I'm probably going to go and do 6 miles around the trails straight away after this, and I'm excited to do it, because it's going to start raining tomorrow, and it's going to rain for the next 10 days. This is going to be my last good, clear day to run outside, so when it's raining, be inside on the treadmill. But I'm at the point where I'm excited to run. So yeah, but getting there was hard. It was one of those forcing myself to get out there and run, but it's cold, but it's wet, whatever, you know. But I mix outdoor running with treadmill, and the treadmill, I've got one of those apps where you can run along with people in different parts of the world. So yeah, working through a series with this guy who's in training for a half marathon, and he's doing these runs in Bolivia, and so some days you do like half hour runs, some it's hour and a half runs, whatever. And yeah, it's kind of a bit more interesting because you're seeing the mountains of Bolivia or the beaches of Costa Rica or wherever. Makes it a bit more interesting. So just having that nudge of need to the next one in the series gets you going. And then you get the point where I am now, where it's like, I want to go and run because it feels good. But it's hard to get to that point. It really is hard to get to that point.
Do you have any distractions? Are you listening to any podcasts or like anything that you routinely listen to while you're running?
So if I'm on the treadmill, obviously it's the app where I'm going through the particular place and the person you're running with is narrating the whole thing. So that's, I guess, kind of like a podcast. You usually mixture of running tips plus information about the area. If I'm outside, I just put music on and I just enjoy the trails. You know, yeah, I live in a really nice part of the world. So the Pacific Northwest, where I am, it's green. Washington State is the evergreen state. We've got great mixture of evergreen trees, deciduous trees, lots of lovely trails. And so it's just the sheer pleasure of put on some good tunes outside in there, in amongst the trees, running through the trails and just enjoying nature. And then you get in that meditative state where your mind starts wandering and you start solving work problems or making plans, and you just kind of, it becomes that meditative thing. So, you know, I've got some stuff I need to do around messaging for pieces, so that's going to be noodling away in my head whilst I'm running. So it's kind of work time, really. But yeah, right. It's kind of nice to get to that meditative point where your brain can solve problems while you're running and just out there enjoying the weather, enjoying the trees, enjoying the trails, some nice music on there, and you're just happy. Yeah.
You're doing internal research. Big fan of that. Are there any other daily routines or habits that you feel like have led to your success?
No, I mean, I'm not one of those people like, oh, I get up every morning, I read 7 books and what have you. The biggest thing that's made me successful in the last 6-7 years is understanding flexibility. So remote work has really helped with this, because it means I structure my day around what I need to do and what is the most productive way for me, rather than structuring my day around a commute to an office and sitting down at a desk. So I vary where I work from based off my needs. I structure my day based off my needs. Just little dumb things, like I structure my Fridays around laundry. I need a cup of coffee, some laundry on. It's almost like the Pomodoro timer type idea of you've got half an hour to focus on one task. I've got one load of laundry to focus on one task. And then by the end of Friday, all my laundry's done. So I don't have to stress about that the weekend. And it's just like, just embracing that flexibility. You see me here, I've got my Star Wars Lego behind me. I've got a sofa bed on the other side of my office, and sometimes I'll sit on that. There's a coffee shop, 15 minutes walk away. Sometimes I'll go and sit there. And just getting that constant change of pace and knowing that when I think about the task that I have to do, thinking about how my environment and timing applies that task to be the most productive. I am most productive writing the latter part of the day. And so, you know, if I know I've got a lot of writing to do, then you know what? I will make sure that I do everything else up to maybe like 1 o'clock. And then I will sit down and from 1 o'clock onwards, I'm writing. And I know that that is my most productive time. When I usually start work early, not because I'm an early riser, I am not, but my kid goes to school, my wife's an elementary school teacher. I start work as soon as they leave the house, because what else am I going to do? They leave the house at 7:20. What else am I going to do? So I will think about planning my day first thing in the morning. What do I need to do? What is the one most important, impactful thing I need to get done today? That's my priority. How do I fit that around my day? Where do I put my run in during my day? How do I put that? Work out the time slot for the run that, again, is going to be the most impactful, because I know that I'm going to have something I'm working on, so I need the mental break from it, or I need something I need to think about so I can think about it on my run. How do I structure that? And so it's understanding my personal needs, wants, desires, and efficiencies, and building my day around that. I think that's taken a lot of kind of personal introspection, a lot of kind of personal growth, to realize that, yes, I can build my day around me. And I think the rise of the remote workplace is really helping a lot of people with this, because back in the days when I had to go to an office, if I wasn't in the right headspace to do a creative task, tough. I have to sit at my desk and do it. And it doesn't necessarily produce the best output. But whereas I'm at home, I can go, you know what? I'm not focused on this task. Let me walk to the coffee shop. It's a 15-minute walk. That's enough time for my brain to sit and process it. And then I can sit down and do the task.
Good advice. Yeah, I'm really good at time blocking, but I like your idea of changing this location, because I spend way too much time in here. Mm-hmm. I even work out in here, because I got a treadmill right behind me, and I'll put on something on YouTube on the screen here, and then in between sets, maybe an email comes in, and I'm like, okay, what is that? Oh, okay, yeah, I should answer that now, or no, it's not nothing to rush for right there. and hop back on. But yeah, I need to get in the habit of changing my location. I feel like that's probably just based on specific tasks, because you can't do everything in this cave, because it's like a Star Wars cave. It's dark in here. I got a window, but maybe I'm getting some vitamin D deficiency or something like that, you know?
If you can find the right place for the different activities that you're doing, that really does help. I've got a nice setup here. You know, ultra-wide monitor. I've got the light, the down light for the desk, my laptop. I've got my big mic. I've got my lights, my camera. Yeah, this is great for when I'm talking to people, when I'm working on kind of the creative tasks where I need a lot of space. But if I'm writing, this is not a good place for me just to sit and write. If I'm writing up, say, some course materials or long blog posts, that sitting down on a sofa with just a laptop screen narrows my focus to what I'm doing.
Right.
So the change of environment is not just to mix it up. It's knowing which activities are more effective in which location, and then just moving to that location. So this is my general place. That is my writing corner. The coffee shop is that I have lots of bitty tasks to do that I need to kind of zip around in. Location. Coffee shop is also the when I need the 15-minute headspace clearing to walk location. And just, yeah, it's understanding who you are as a human and optimizing what you do based off that. It's like I've been trying to help out with some of our bugs recently, go through some of our bug tracking and just, no, this is an old one, this has been fixed. Not an exciting task, but every Thursday evening, my kid goes to an art class that's next to a really nice local brewery. So you know what? I'll drop them off at art. Wander to the brewery, sit down, having a beer, close the bug.
And it's great idea.
Activity that fits in with the location. I don't need too much concentration. So I have a beer, closing bugs, when my kids are art class. So yeah, just knowing where I can be the most productive at different tasks and different locations, times and places allows me to streamline what I'm doing. And also knowing when to have a nap as well. I'm a big fan of naps. Sometimes it's like, you know what, nothing's getting done. That sofa bed, I'm having a nap.
Yeah, even then, 8 minutes sometimes is a game changer. Just a short one.
Yep, not really so long that you're groggy afterwards. Just enough to relax your mind a bit, and then you come back to it with a renewed focus. Big fan of that.
Well, great combo so far. We're coming up on our budgeted 90 minutes here. I guess, do you have any last minute questions for a recruiter by chance?
Yeah, one thing I keep saying to early career folks looking for work, and I'm just curious your take on this, is the power of networking, the fact that you won't get a job through applying with everyone else, you'll get a job through knowing someone. I'd love for you to share your thoughts on that, because I think this is, I've got a lot of jobs based off who I know.
Right.
So yeah, I guess, what are your top tips as a recruiter really for helping these early in career folks build their network? Because I'm always after more advice on what to give people.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a hierarchy of priority level, you know, when a job is open, the number one spot goes to internal employees who are trying to apply for that job. The number two spot is referrals from internal employees, people that would vouch for you. So the saying goes, like, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And I'll disagree with that. It's actually not who you know, it's who knows you and who's going to recommend you when they have an opportunity. So you need an army of those people out there, especially as a job seeker. People don't like to do much in terms of self-promotion, but you got to get out of your comfort zone and just leave your imposter syndrome at the door. And, you know, there's no shame in calling the people that you know and telling them, hey, look, I'm actually on the market. You know, can you help me? Can you recommend me? Do you know anybody? People shy away from that because maybe it's pride or fear or something. You know, there's some reason that people won't do it. It's just uncomfortable, but you have to. There's no faster way in. There's no better way in than an internal referral. So you got to do it. If you're just sitting around applying to jobs online and not trying to get the attention of a human that can help you afterwards, then you're going to be stuck in the resume black hole for a long time. It doesn't matter how good your resume is. Much better if there's quite a few follow-up tasks and leverage LinkedIn, leverage your network, beg for favors. You got
to
do it.
I think also as well, it's try not to be a taker. Try and be a giver as well. Because if you just use your network for yourself, that is a horrible way to have a network. It's how do you also help other people? If someone reaches out to you for help, are you there helping them? How are you supporting others? So that when you do lean into your network and say, look, I need help with this, people don't see you as someone who just turns up when you need help. you're someone who's there all the time.
Yeah, there's some truth to that. I'll definitely agree. And there's a law of reciprocity, right? So if you do something for someone, they're, it's kind of in our nature, going to feel like returning the favor. So use that to your advantage. You know, give trust to get trust. And if you're looking for recommendations on LinkedIn, the way to get a recommendation is to give a recommendation and just write something on somebody's profile that is positive review. And then they'll probably want to return the favor. That's how you get the review. So use that to your advantage. Also, you know, people, they want to help you, right? If you ask for someone's help, just hearing those words, most human beings will try to help, you know, even if you haven't done them anything. So just don't be afraid to ask. And yeah, I would agree. Try to add more value than you're taking. That's a good point. It's a delicate balance of things that you're trying to juggle on the job search. You know, you got to do everything.
And I guess as well, network continuously.
Don't
just network when you need a job. Network continuously because you never know when you'll need that job. So always keep those connections going. Always be friendly. You connect with someone on LinkedIn who you meet at an event, send them a message straight away afterwards. So you've got some point of reference. And just grow your network all the time because that way it's there when you need it rather than that mad panic of, I need a job. Oh, crap. I need to build a network now.
Agreed. Well, thanks for all your contributions to the developer community and the open source community. And you're a big time giver, man. I'm a fan and we're brothers in Star Wars. And if you ever need anything from me, you just let me know, man. Be glad to help you.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun. And may the force be with you.
May the force be with you. This is the way.